Okay, so thanks, guys. I'm very glad to be giving this talk. I'm very sorry that the in-person did not work out last week, but this is it did give me a little more time to polish up the slides, so I'm a little bit grateful. So here we are. And before I dive into this somewhat technical topic, I want to give a little pitch for what it is that I do in physics. I'm quite interested in the history of physics, and so now that snow mass is wrapping up, I decided to spend some time looking back at past snow masses to see what people used to talk about back in the day. And you look at the snow mass 1982 summary, it's a lot simpler to think about. You have, the standard model, you have the three theories, Technicolor, supersymmetry, and granularification, and we have new ideas for accelerators. And if you go all the way to 2007 and you ask people, and this is a poll of experimentalists, you say, what are we going to find at the LHC? And there's pretty big odds. They say, it's standard model, 2-to-1 odds, supersymmetry, 5-to-1. This reflects a great deal of unity in the field. Then if you go to this year's snow mass and the interest survey, there's a bewildering amount of frontiers and subfrontiers totaling nearly 100, with people evenly distributed across many, many different kinds of physics. And so the underlying thing that's been going on here is that it's become a little bit more difficult for a young scientist to choose what to work on. There's two aspects of this problem. The first is that there are now many, many more interesting beyond the standard model theories, but I think we could all agree that no single one of them has anywhere near the odds, the general acceptance that supersymmetry did 15 years ago. At the same time, you could try to think about the many exciting new technologies and instruments that are being developed now, but it's hard to say where you can make an impact really, because each one already has its own domain experts who have been studying for years. But fortunately, there is a middle path, which is that you can try to link these new theories and the new technologies that can test them, which requires, of course, working across fields. And this works out because physics is a very big place and many exciting connections have not yet been made. So as a case study, we could talk about the broadening scope of the search for dark matter. And so this is a rather old plot, which is already out of date, but it shows the diversity of the field. Right now, we have both a large number of canonical dark matter models we'd like to decisively test. And we also have broad, unexplored entire class of models that we don't really know how to test yet. And new experimental programs can help us with both these problems. So that's what I've been doing for the majority of my PhD. I have various works on like new ways of testing either canonical models or exploring broadly to new kinds of models. And so this is mo mostly what I do. So I'm happy to talk about any of this stuff. I just wanted to give this overview before I jump into this, what this talk is about. So this talk has nothing to do with anything I just said. It is not about dark matter at all. It is about how to experimentally resolve a foundational open question in relativistic quantum field theory. But the reason I put this intro in is because actually the underlying spirit is still the same. What we're trying to do with a theory of continuous spin particles is to produce new links between theory and experiments. And here, the challenge is a little bit different because it wasn't about finding the right kind of new technology or anything like that. Here, the challenge was on the theory end. The theory was not well developed enough to make any predictions. And so what we've been trying to do is trying to understand exactly how do these particles behave in a way that's relevant for real experiments, and how can we test these things? So let me jump in to answering the question of what is a continuous spin particle? So one of the most beautiful things about quantum field theory is that the combination of quantum mechanics and special relativity very strongly restrict the kinds of particles that can exist in our world. And so this was all worked out by Wigner almost 100 years ago. And the way you can do it is you can think about the casework for the four momentum of particles. So there's four cases. First case is that it's always equal to zero, and that's not actually a particle at all. That's a vacuum expectation value. We understand what that is. Second case is that p squared is always negative, and that corresponds to what we call a tachyon, but we also know that doesn't really correspond to physical particles. It indicates there's an instability in your theory. So that's understood as well. And then the two more familiar cases are when the p squared is equal to zero, meaning a massless particle, and when p squared is greater than zero, indicating a massive particle. And we also know massive particles are characterized by their mass m and spin j, which is integer or half integer. So this has been all known for a very long time. Now, in the case of massless particles, we can also go a little bit further in analysis. We are particularly interested in massless bosons because those are the only kinds of particles that mediate long-range forces, which are macroscopically visible in our universe. However, we also know that these particles are extremely highly constrained. And so Weinberg's soft theorems told us a lot about what we can expect to see in terms of massless particles. First off, most of the time we consider massless particles with definite helicity, And so for bosons, they'd have to have integer helicity. And so now if we work through the integers, for the case of helicity zero, we don't see any of those particles. But we also have a good reason we don't see any of them, which is that for them to be massless, there would have to be a fine tuning because there's no particular reason, symmetry-based reason, for them to protect their zero mass. For a helicity of one, we can have a naturally massless boson, but we also know from Weinberg's soft theorems that there's a constraint on how it interacts with matter, which is that it has to couple to a conserved charge. And the main example of that in our universe is the photon, which couples to the conserved electric charge. When you go to helicity two, it turns out that it has to couple universally to the stress energy tensor, which means automatically that any such particle has to be the graviton, which we also do seem to have in our universe. And then Weinberg's soft theorems also say if you keep doing this logic and go to helicity greater than two, then you cannot interact, or at least you can't be a fundamental particle and still interact. And indeed, we don't see any of these particles. So it seems it's a very nice story. Everything is very compact. Everything that can exist, either we know exists, or we know a good reason why it does not exist. However, there is a bit of a catch to this, which is that this is not really a complete story. This is really a degenerate special case of the full story. So I just talked about the case of massless particles with definite helicity H, but in the generic massless particle representation, as in the general thing the math tells you should exist, and this is something historically called a continuous spin particle for purely historical reasons, it's kind of confusing. The key thing that these particles differ at is that their helicity states can mix under Lorentz transformations. And so you can start with helicity, say, three, and then after doing some kind of boost in rotation, you can have a particle with helicity two, for example. This automatically implies there's two classes of these particles. One is the bosonic CSP, which is the one where you have all integer helicities. You can start with any helicity and any integer helicity, and then you can boost and rotate it into any other integer helicity. And also you have the fermionic CSP, which has all half integer helicities, but since that doesn't mediate long-range forces, we won't consider that here. So now this immediately presents two questions. The first is, why isn't this mentioned in the standard textbooks? And that really is just for historical factors, and also because it's kind of technically difficult to deal with all these different helicity states at the same time. The second question you could ask is, why does this not show up in nature? And the actual answer is not that it shouldn't, but actually we don't know if it does. So in the past, it was thought that there were various arguments, very heuristic, intuitive arguments that showed why these things should not exist in nature. But unfortunately, none of them really hold up to the scrutiny. And a lot of that work that showed that these things were actually viable particles was done right here at the Perimeter Institute. So the first thing you might ask is, what about the Weinberg soft theorems? As I just said, the Weinberg soft theorems say that you can't have helicity greater than two, and these things require all helicities. The reason that they don't apply is because they just kind of assume from the very first step that the helicity is Lorentz invariant. So they just simply don't apply to continuous spin particles at all. If you do take the same kind of argument and apply it to a continuous spin particle, then it turns out nothing goes wrong. There are these amplitudes for soft CSP emission, which are perfectly finite and well-behaved. The next thing people say is that it's incompatible with field theory. And this is kind of confusing because it is indeed kind of difficult to embed these kinds of particles, which have many degrees of freedom, into a quantum field. And so people thought maybe this is just inherently impossible to write in quantum field theory. It turns out that's not true either. It is a little bit tricky, and I'll explain how it's done later in this talk. But the upshot was that indeed a simple free field action was found at Perimeter about 8 years ago. Next, some people say, well, because there's an infinite number of degrees of freedom, it should be ruled out by thermodynamics. That just seems like seems kind of odd. There should be some way that this is physically pathological. And it turns out that if you have a small enough value of the spin scale, rho, which is the thing that controls the mixing between these helicity states, then the answer is no, actually. It actually just reduces to ordinary particles, and the thermodynamics is perfectly well behaved. And again, in a way that I'll describe in more detail later in this talk. The final thing people say is maybe these have no experimental relevance because we don't see any of these particles. It doesn't look like there's any particles with arbitrary helicities. And so this is actually, this argument was circumvented in kind of an in a surprising way, an unexpected way, which is that it turns out if you analyze the soft theorem arguments, only three kinds of CSP interactions can possibly exist. And when you take the limit, rho goes to zero, you actually get back exactly the same thing as amplitudes for scalars, gauge bosons, and gravitons. And so it's not that we don't see these particles, it's actually that These things mimic the familiar particles, photons and gravitons, that we already know about when rho is a small number. And that suggests that the photon and graviton actually could be CSPs, and we actually wouldn't know. So then there's a final objection, which is that this is all very strange and unfamiliar, which is absolutely true. On the other hand, CSPs are a very well theoretically motivated infrared deformation of familiar gauge theories. And in addition, they might play a role in the resolution of a lot of longstanding problems of the standard model. So I think that is motivation enough to consider these in greater detail. Okay, so before I jump into the more technical aspects, are there any questions? I can't really see if there are any in the audience.
Well, you'll explain what rho is, right?
Yes, that's right. When we get to that, to the end, it'll get a little more hand-wavy, admittedly, but I will try to explain it, yes.
Okay.
Can I ask you something, Kane? So how is this? So there's this thing that's called like parastatistics, that it's trying to extend. So you have fermion statistics, boson statistics. Here you will have a different statistic, I guess, right? There's these things.
Actually, no. So this is because we have all integer, we're considering a bosonic CSP with all integer helicities. The usual argument that these things, by the spin statistics theorem, have bosonic statistics, it goes through unchanged for CSPs. So these are just ordinary bosonic fields. They commute at space-like separation, all that kind of stuff.
Okay, sounds good.
Okay, cool. Okay, so now the key open question in order to test anything about CSP physics is that we didn't know enough about how they interacted with ordinary matter. And so the first thing is, as I said earlier, there are these soft theorem arguments that give you unique amplitudes for the emission and absorption of soft CSPs, which is a very nice theoretical result. But unfortunately, this has very limited applicability. This is not enough to actually describe any experiments. The second thing is that you can write down ansatz amplitudes for CSP exchange. And you can, there are several candidates. You can write them down. They do obey factorization, you know, tree-level unitarity. Everything seems to make sense. Everything's finite. But the problem is these are not uniquely determined, and there doesn't seem to be any constructive way of enumerating all the possibilities. And if we don't know which possibility to use, we don't really have any sharp predictions. The third thing is that we do have a free field theory of CSPs, and we can easily couple it to an external current. But unfortunately, until now, there was no known sources of this current. If just this magical background field, we didn't know where it came from. And so that means if we don't know what the source is, we don't know how the field is created. So what's changed and what is going to be the main topic of this talk is that we now know how to couple matter particles to CSP fields. And even more remarkably, the results for radiation emission and absorption are completely unique. So they don't matter, they don't depend at all on the details of how you perform this coupling, which means that we get extremely sharp predictions out and extremely specific experimental tests of whether CSPs exist. So here's my outline for the rest of this talk. There's going to be three parts. First is I'm going to review the free CSP field, which is just some technical stuff which just needs to be reviewed to talk about the other stuff. Then I'll talk about how to couple matter particles to these fields. And finally, I'll talk about our results for the emission and absorption of CSP radiation when these matter particles move around. So first off, how do we describe a free CSP? Well, before we talk about the field theory, we need to talk about particle CSPs. So what is, in general, a massless particle? So the definition in quantum field theory is that a particle means a degree of freedom that retains its identity when you translate it, boost it, or rotate it. And so in more technical terms, this means the state space has to be a representation of the Poincaré group. Now, particles, of course, have momentum, which can be changed by these boosts and rotations. And they also have internal degrees of freedom. And to figure out what those are, we consider Lorentz transformations that don't change momentum and just shuffle around the internal degrees of freedom. And these things are called little group elements. In the case of a massless particle, we can take the momentum to be parallel to the z-axis. And then there are three operations we can do that don't change the momentum, but can possibly change the internal states. One of them is a rotation r about the z-axis. And the other two are these things where you simultaneously rotate a little bit to change the momentum. And then you boost to undo the change. And so these are called T1 and T2. And they involve transverse rotations and boosts. So there's three of these things that can happen. The eigenvalue of r, which is the rotation about the momentum axis, is by definition the helicity of the particle. And this is going to be always an integer or a half integer. As long as you're talking about standard representation theory, it has to be an integer or half integer. Nothing but CSPs changes this.
Sorry, Kevin?
Yes?
Can I ask, what happens for massive? Are there massive series continuous spin presentations?
Because oh, yeah.
In the
massive case, a CSP actually, so there's a physical way of understanding where a CSP comes from, which is that it is actually, in some sense, a massive particle where the mass goes to zero and the spin goes to infinity while their product stays the same. So in that sense, this is kind of one of those reasons people call these like infinite spin particles sometimes. So in that sense, the same idea of having infinitely many internal degrees of freedom, that's already there baked into the massive case because you can just take the spin to infinity. So the usual classification for massive particles is already complete. Massive particles.
Sorry, you're going to talk about the photons. How do you do electroweak symmetry breaking?
We don't understand the CSP theory well enough to talk about Higgsing a CSP or electroweak symmetry breaking. That's all a very, very interesting open question that we just don't know enough about to say yet. I will mention a bit more about it later. But the answer is that we just know. So now we consider what happens. What are these little group transformations that can mix up the internal states? We have the helicity, which has to be integer, half integer. And then we have these T operators. And if you work through the representation theory, it turns out they have to either increase or decrease helicity by one. And the factor you get along with that is this number called the spin scale rho. Whenever we consider massless particles in textbooks, we just set rho to zero. That's just done sometimes even implicitly without even mentioning it. And so the representation only has one helicity state, which is how you get these particles with definite helicity like the photon. However, what the math is telling us is that the general case is that rho is non-zero. And that means you automatically get all integer or all half integer helicities. And as I said earlier, I'm going to focus on the integer case only in this talk. So now that we have the particle content, we want to be able to write a quantum field that can create and annihilate this particle. And as a warm-up, let's first set rho to zero and just think about the abstract question of how can we consider a single quantum field that creates particles of any helicity H? This is something that's a little technical, but it can be done with the standard tools. So for helicity H particles, the simplest possible field that can create these particles turns out to be a rank H symmetric tensor field. And so what you would like to have is, in order to have enough freedom in the field, you would want to have like a rank zero tensor, a rank one tensor, a symmetric rank two tensor, a symmetric rank three tensor, and so on, all at the same time. A convenient way to package all this information simultaneously is to have a field that is also a function of this auxiliary four vector eta. And the reason that works is when you Taylor expand the field in eta, you automatically get all these arbitrary rank symmetric tensors. Like that's just how the Taylor expansion works. And here I'm suppressing various trace subtractions and normalization factors, but this is in spirit how it works and why adding an extra variable gives you all the information you need. At the same time, when you write down an action, this has too many degrees of freedom in order to get the particles you want, because you only want one degree of freedom per helicity, and these tensors have more. And so that means for all the tensors of rank one and above, you also need some kind of gauge symmetry in the field to get rid of the extra degrees of freedom. So this is just how it is in QED and gravity. It turns out that the right action to have in order to get one particle of each helicity is this action right here. So there's an integral over spacetime and an integral over this auxiliary four vector eta. And then there's some delta functions of eta plus eta squared plus one, which localize you to a hyperboloid in eta space. So it does look a little bit strange, but this is just notation. And so the integration over this hyperboloid, it does have a deep geometric meaning. Like there's a reason why the representation theory tells you should have something like this in the action. Which I don't have time to explain today. So I'm just going to not explain it at all. And also, it turns out to be infinite generically. So you need some kind of regularization scheme, which is also well-defined. But it basically boils down to saying that these elementary integrals have to be equal to one. They're normalized. The measures are normalized this way. When you do these integrals, basically what they do is they just produce tensor contractions. So for example, if you integrated over a delta function, eta mu, eta nu, what you end up getting is the metric. And if you integrate with a delta prime, you also get a metric with a different prefactor. And if you integrate arbitrary numbers of etas, you just get more and more copies of the metric. So it is really just a tool for doing tensor contractions. So now let me show you how this, the nuts and bolts of how this works. The first simplest case is, let's just consider the scalar component of this field. So if phi is equal to, psi is equal to phi of x, so the eta independent parts, when we plug this into the action, what do we get? First off, the derivative of psi just becomes the derivative of phi. And this first eta integral just gives you one, as I said with the normalization earlier. The second term involves an eta derivative acting on psi, which is just zero. And so the second term just vanishes. And so when you do the eta integral, you end up getting 1/2 times the integral of del x psi squared, which is, of course, as the ordinary action for massless scalar fields. So this is completely familiar. A slightly less trivial example is when you have a vector component. So let's consider the case where psi, the linear in eta part, which is eta dot a. Now, when you plug it in, there's a few more steps. So first off, when you plug in del x psi, that ends up being, there's a derivative acting on a. And also in the second term actually is non-zero now, and that gives you del mu a mu. From this point on, you can now do both of the eta integrals. So the first one requires doing this contraction among the two copies of eta. And when you do those, you end up getting -1/2 del mu a nu squared plus 1/2 del mu a nu squared, which is of course just the ordinary Maxwell action. So more generally, you can keep going to higher and higher ranks. And at rank 2, you will recover linearized gravity. And at rank h, you're going to recall what is known as the Fronsdahl action for a massless helicity h particle. Everything works out exactly as you'd expect. It matches exactly the standard formulas. And also all the gauge symmetries you need are automatically recovered. So this does contain everything we know about massless particles already in there. Now you might ask, what is the dynamical content? I told you what are the fields, but what are the actual degrees of freedom that these fields encode? So you can write down what the plane wave expansion is. So the plane wave solutions look like e to the minus ik dot x times eta dot epsilon plus minus to the h. And epsilon plus minus is just a polarization vector, like the circular polarization of the photon or something. These things all have helicity h as advertised, and they are annihilated by t plus minus, which corresponds to having rho is equal to zero. Furthermore, when you account for all the gauge redundancy in the system, this is actually a complete basis for all solutions. So this is the full dynamical content right here. And finally, one thing you can notice is that the rank in eta, so the number of powers of eta, corresponds exactly to what the helicity is, or the absolute value of the helicity. And so that means that you can, if you want, you can just go back, you can get rid of this eta stuff and just say, I'm going to take the rank h parts of psi, and that will be the helicity h part of the field. So you can easily go back and forth between the usual tensor notation, where there's one of each kind of tensor, and this function of eta. There's like, these are completely equivalent. So everything I've told you so far, this is the case where rho is equal to zero, and you have just one copy of each helicity. And so for a CSB, what we need to do is turn rho to be non-zero, and that turns out to be miraculously simple. All you need to do is take the previous action and add rho over here in red. And so what ends up happening is that you still have one of each helicity, you still have all the required gauge symmetries. When you take rho to zero, you manifestly get back one particle of each helicity, which is what we have described earlier. And you can then write down the plane wave solutions, which now look a little bit different. So now the difference is that there's a factor of e to the minus I rho eta dot q in there, where q is this auxiliary vector that has q dot k is equal to one. And they're indeed related by t plus minus. So if you act by t plus on this thing, you'll get the next helicity up times rho, which is, I mean, I'm skipping over some details. Like that takes a couple pages of algebra to prove, but that is something that just falls out of the math. Now, from this alone, you can see something important, which is that these plane wave solutions with definite helicity are not definite order in eta. So they have all orders in eta because of the exponentials in front. And that means if you try to describe the plane wave solutions for CSPs in terms of the tensor expansion going order by order in eta, even the simplest plane wave has contributions at every order in eta, so every kind of tensor. And that's kind of why, if you try to just approach this with a brute force, writing down the most general tensors, it gets extremely confusing extremely quickly. And that's one of the reasons that no one was able to write down this theory before my advisors did 10 years ago. In order to have a compact expression for everything going on, you really do need this auxiliary variable eta. So this is everything that you need, yes?
Yeah, like, so earlier you showed us like, if you have even number of eta, like then those turn into metric. Like, is it easy to see like, when you have all of these terms, there are no terms that is odd power in eta?
Sure thing. So So you do get odd powers of eta in this action, but they all end up being zero. So the real statement to prove is that when you do this integral, you will just get zero if there's an odd number of etas. There's two ways. One is that when you try to define this carefully with analytic continuation, that's just what happens. And the second way is that this has to respect Lorentz invariance, and you can't write down any answer on the right-hand side with three indices.
Yeah. That's why I was asking. Okay,
cool. Anything else? Okay, so now let me move on to the dynamics. How do we actually couple this field to anything to get any physics out? And so now I'll talk about how to couple matter particles to these fields. So before we do that, there's a general question of how do we couple an external current to a field? And of course, we know how to do this for ordinary fields. So if you had a scalar field, all you would do is you would add interaction phi j, and then the equation of motion become del squared phi is equal to j. And a very similar thing happens for vector field. You would add interaction a mu j mu, and you get an equation of motion del squared a mu equals j mu in Lorentz gauge. So very similar thing happens for CSP fields. You can just add on a term which has j times psi, where this j, of course, also has to be a function of eta. And now the CSP field equation of motion is now del squared psi is equal to j in an appropriate gauge. And of course, when you Taylor expand this in eta and set rho to zero, of course, you have the scalar and the vector are both contained here. In addition, whenever you have this kind of background field, you need to make sure that the action remains gauge invariant. And so that gives you a non-trivial condition. So for vector fields, we know that condition is that del mu j mu is equal to zero. So j mu has to be conserved. And there's an analogous condition called the continuity condition for CSP fields, which is that del x dot del eta plus rho acting on j has to be equal to zero on the hyperboloid eta squared plus one is equal to zero. And so this is a little bit different. And if you Taylor expand it, you'll find that for non-zero rho, this means that the, for example, if the rank one j mu component is non-zero, it's not actually conserved. It's actually slightly non-conserved, but the non-conservation is related to the size of this rank two component and so on. So it's a little bit different than the conservation conditions we're used to seeing, but it's derived the same way. Now, we want to write down a matter sector that gives you this kind of current. And so if we want to analyze a low energy precision experiment, we want to consider classical particle matter. Now, of course, we could describe any experiment using quantum field theory for the matter, but usually in practice, you would just have to reduce the quantum field theory all the way back down to a classical particle theory, you'd have to undo all the steps anyway. So considering classical particles is the case that matters for most precision experiments, at least at low energies. Now, when you write down a current that comes from a particle, of course, it has to obey Poincaré invariance and the continuity condition, if there is one. And for simplicity, you could write down all kinds of weird stuff, but the leading currents that we know about in existing theories have two properties. First off, they're local to the world line. And second off, they only depend on the position of the particle, z mu, and the four velocity, z dot mu. So there are other ones, and this gives you two unique answers for scalars and vectors, which are shown here. There's delta functions localizing into the world line. Of course, there are other possibilities. And for example, you can have subleading interactions involving higher rank derivatives, so the acceleration and the jerk. And also there are spin couplings involving the spin of the particle, if there is one, which you would have copy the spin tensor in here. But the leading effect is the one that is shown here. Now, this contains a lot of physics because it not only determines how particles source the field, it also tells you by evaluating the Euler-Lagrange equations, it tells you how they're acted on by the field. So you get the equation of motion for the particle, which is there's one for the scalar, and of course we have the Lorentz force law for the vector. And so this just simple current right here, of course, encompasses a vast range of physics, such as everything that's in Jackson, for example. Now we want to do the same thing for the CSPs. And so the CSP currents, it's more convenient to write this in Fourier space. And so the Fourier transform of CSP currents, we can write down as integral of e to the I k dot z times a function of z dot k and eta. The continuity condition, which is required for gauge invariance, is now minus ik to del eta plus rho, the del x becomes minus ik. And so we have this condition. Now, the first thing we can notice about this condition is that for this the continuity condition to be true, f needs to have some k dependence. And that corresponds to having a current that is not automatically perfectly localized to the world line. So we need to throw out perfect localization from the get-go. There's something also, but a worse problem is that apparently there are many possibilities for what f can be. And so, for example, it's relatively straightforward to check that if f is equal to e to the minus I rho a to dot v over k dot v for any vector v, then this continuity condition is satisfied. And so this gives you some very qualitatively different possibilities depending on what you choose for v. So for example, if you choose v to be equal to z dots, you'll get something we call the temporal current. And you choose v to be perpendicular to z dots, which is this other thing here, you get what we call the spatial currents. And these seem to give you very different current profiles. And finally, there's another technical problem, which is that there's an essential singularity whenever k dot v is equal to zero. And that makes it so that actually evaluating the Fourier transform to go back to space is kind of tricky. But the main issue here, so a lot of these are just technical issues, but the main issue is that there's more than one possibility. And that seems to be a little bit of a problem if we want to get out definite predictions. So I'll come back to this in a second. First off, you can calculate the static field of a particle that isn't moving for both the temporal current and the spatial currents. It is tricky because you need to deal with these essential singularities, and there needs to be like an I epsilon regulator and stuff like that, but everything ends up being completely well-behaved. And so what you end up getting is the usual 1 over r fall off times these weird Bessel functions involving rho. And they do look completely different. So you'll notice the temporal current corresponds to a current that's perfectly localized at the origin, giving you a perfectly 1 over r field, but it's not perfectly time translation invariant. The spatial current is delocalized on the scale 1 over r rho, but it is time translation invariant. So it seems that these are extremely different from each other. And furthermore, given these kinds of things, trying to calculate the velocity dependent force corrections, as in like what is the force between two moving particles, is quite difficult. And furthermore, it's very unclear how general the answer is, because if you take one current and calculate the answer, you might not get the same answer from a different current. Actually, we do believe that a lot of these currents give you the exact same answer. So a lot of this difference is pure gauge redundancy. It looks different, but it actually is the same thing. But it is a little bit difficult to see this. There's also something very interesting going on here, which is that the currents seem to inherently require substructure on the scale 1 over r, which is a bit strange, especially when you consider that taking rho to zero should give you back the ordinary particles we know about. But in fact, that's exactly what happens. When you take rho to zero, these Bessel functions are just evaluated at zero, and you get one, and you get the ordinary 1 over r. So everything does actually perfectly recover ordinary photons and gravitons in that limit. So this is a little discouraging. Even though we were able to calculate things, it is a little discouraging, but it turns out that we can answer an easier first question. And it turns out that answer has that question has a definite answer. So the easier question we can answer is forget about general interactions between particles coupled to CSPs. Let's consider particles just emitting and absorbing on-shell CSP radiation, which again is a very wide class, describes a very wide class of experiments. When k squared is equal to zero, it turns out the spatial current simplifies a lot. And so what you end up getting is that you end up getting the temporal current times this exponential, which can be expanded as 1 plus f tilde, where f tilde has all terms proportional to eta dot k. And if you work through the mathematics, this implies, and this is several pages, which I don't have room to show here, that in the gauge we've been using implicitly this whole time, this extra term does not contribute to the action at all. It just drops out. And so what ends up what this means is that the action due to the corresponding to emitting and absorbing on-shell radiation is exactly the same for these two different currents, even though they look completely different. Our core technical result of this paper, and kind of the reason that we're writing a paper at all about this, is that we found this phenomenon is completely general. It's extremely general. When you consider on-shell CSP emission and absorption, all currents give you the same answer. So out of the infinite class of possible currents you can write down, there's only three possibilities. So f in general is a function of k dot z dot times this exponential of e to the minus I rho a to dot z dot over k dot z dot. Now, in order to recover an ordinary massless particle when you take rho to zero, there's three possibilities. The first is that h is a constant, and this will give you what's called the scalar CSP. The second is that h is linear in k dot z dot, which will give you the vector CSP. And the third is that h is quadratic, in which case you get the graviton CSP. And so all of these things reduce automatically to something that looks like a photon or a graviton, or I guess a massless scalar, when rho is small. And there are no other possibilities for radiation emission. And so this immediately motivates finding the corrections to radiation emission and the forces from radiation absorption for both the case where the photon is a vector CSP, which is the focus of the rest of this talk, and the case where the graviton is a graviton CSP. And this is motivated because the answer is completely unique and only depends on one parameter rho. So now I'm going to enumerate some of these results. I'll pause here if there are any questions.
So Kevin, this is all classical, right?
That's correct. Everything is classical. I will come back to this later. You can canonically quantize, we believe pretty straightforwardly. So the CSP field is just a free field with a current. So that can be canonically quantized completely trivially. And then we think that...
For example, can you put it in loops?
Loops. Well, okay. So we tried doing loops, but this is again, it's a level of technical difficulty above what we're able to do yet. We have thought a little bit about loop corrections. We don't have enough to write something concrete yet. So one thing we can say we expect, for example, is that loop corrections to CSP propagators should keep them massless, because for the same reason that loop corrections to photon and graviton propagators keep them massless, because there's a very strong gauge symmetry protecting the masslessness. Besides that, we're not really sure. So there are some very fearsome integrals that we need to do. We have some partial progress, but not enough to talk about yet. But yeah, so you could consider doing quantizing the CSP field and calculating loops. But we think the more immediate question is quantizing the matter particle. So you're getting a quantum particle out, and that should be done with just canonical quantization. And then you can talk about, for example, emission and absorption of CSPs from atoms, for example. So now let me move on to the emission and absorption of this classical CSP radiation from classical particles. And so it is, the expressions look a little bit complicated. There's a lot of Bessel functions, but it is all a straightforward exercise in the sense that it is just Jackson, but with more indices. And so the procedure is exactly the same as in Jackson, but you just have a few more things to carry around. And so let's consider, for example, a non-relativistic charge particle moving in periodic motion in period T. And so this will generally produce radiation of various harmonics. And for a CSP, it'll produce radiation of every helicity. If you grind through the calculation, you'll find that the radiation rate, differential and angle, is this expression right here. And this might be a little bit difficult to interpret, but it actually ends up being very simple. You can show that, first off, when you set rho to zero, you recover the ordinary Larmor formula. So everything recovers photons as you'd expect. The second thing is that all the corrections are in this Bessel function right here, and that there is a series in rho v over omega, where v is the typical velocity and omega is the angular frequency of the particle. And so another way of saying this is that all the corrections are power series in rho l squared, where l is the typical length that the particle travels. And so here, as a function of rho l, I show the differential radiation rate along the equator for helicity one and also other ones. So you see that helicity one starts to normalize to one. And then as you increase rho l, you pick up some helicity zero and two, and then to a smaller degree, helicity three and four. The very interesting thing about this is that the corrections automatically go to zero in the UV. So when the length scales are small, then rho l is a small number. And so you just recover back the ordinary electromagnetism formula. So this is a pure infrared deformation of electromagnetism, which motivates very different kinds of experimental tests than we're usually used to. The other side of the question is, let's consider a particle that is inside a radiation background of CSPs. So let's say there's a plane wave CSP radiation passing by a particle with helicity H. What is the interaction Lagrangian of that particle? And so you can again grind through evaluating the action. And it's proportional to, of course, the field amplitude times this funny velocity-dependent Bessel function. And this, again, looks kind of weird, but it is a series. The point is that it's a series in rho times the velocity of the particle. And so when you set rho to zero, you recover the Lorentz force law, which I admit is a little opaque the way it's written right now, but you do get the Lorentz force law back. And then the leading correction is that at order rho v, a helicity h equals zero CSP radiation background does give you a force. It's parallel to the perpendicular velocity, so the part of the velocity perpendicular to the momentum of the CSP field. And so that kind of has some resemblance to how a dilaton acts. And then for the helicity two, you get an order rho v force, which kind of acts like a gravitational wave. Finally, at order rho v squared, the force from helicity one is no longer given by the Lorentz force law. There's a correction, and that correction actually turns out to be parallel to v, which is a very distinctive violation of the Lorentz force law. So this is the kind of correction you get in CSP physics. It's all very calculable, very, very much definite, but it is different enough from what you'd expect from more familiar physics that we don't have distinct experiments that are searching for these things yet. So now the core experimental question, of course, is what are the most effective probes of the photon or the graviton spin scale rho? And so there are a few directions that immediately suggest themselves. The first is, what are the cosmological and astrophysical bounds? So cosmologically, we'd expect CSP radiation backgrounds to be produced in the early universe, if rho is too high, this will mess up early universe thermodynamics. So what is the bound from that? In addition, even if it doesn't mess up the thermodynamics, there is still a radiation background in these other Hilbert modes that is still here today. And perhaps you can detect that like you detect the CMB. There's, of course, the astrophysical aspect, which is that first off, these things might accelerate stellar cooling because these other C-speed degrees of freedom might just sail right out of a star after being produced in the middle. And also, even if they don't screw up stellar cooling, they will be produced in the sun and can get to Earth. And you might be able to detect that from a helioscope. Finally, there's a suggestion that you can do light shining through wall experiments. So you can try to have charges in a cavity, wiggle them, and they will produce helicity 1 along with helicity 0 and 2. Put the whole thing in a shield, helicity 1 is blocked, and then the helicity 0 and 2 propagate to another shielded particle and cause that to wiggle. So that is an example of light shining through wall experiment.
So before you go, may I ask a question? Like, for the things that you discussed earlier, do things work in the near field or it's only far field that you can describe these things?
Okay, yeah, so we believe we understand the far field because we believe that is dominated by the on-shell radiation. Near field is something I'm actually going to get to in the next slide. So we do understand some things about the near field. For example, we know what the field profiles are. And this actually tells us, we're pretty sure this means that there are no static force law corrections. So the force between two particles is still exactly 1/r². But we have not been able to calculate what the velocity-dependent near field force corrections are. Which is kind of important for some class of experimental tests. That requires understanding better how to deal with these central singularities and also being more certain about exactly how dependent the answer is on the choice of currents, which we're not completely sure about yet. So the answer is the near field is the next paper. We're not really sure yet.
Yeah, may I ask, just a different example, can you describe a current loop?
A current loop. So if you have a steady current, I think we can calculate what the near field is, but with the caveat that it will differ depending on what current you choose. We don't have a proof that all different currents will give you gauge equivalent results. So I can't tell you definitely if we'll have an experimental prediction in the near field. That's the main trouble. We can calculate that though. Now, if you have the current loop starting to accelerate around and the current speeding up and slowing down, then that might be too technically difficult to calculate for now. But in principle, we can calculate it.
Okay.
So yeah, that is actually the very next thing that I was going to say, which is that there are open theoretical questions involving CSPs. First is that we need to understand these currents off-shell, which gives you information about the near field. And that's important because it will give you velocity-dependent modifications of force law. So for example, if you want to do a fifth force experiment, this is completely necessary to understand. Unfortunately, this is just a step more technically difficult than what we've done so far. But it is a very natural next step to consider. The second thing is that we want to quantize the whole system. And so it seems like overkill right now to get a quantum field theory of the matter, but you can have a quantum particle theory of the matter coupled to a quantum field theory of the CSPs. We think that should be relatively straightforward to crank out, though it does take work. And that will allow you to describe things such as the atomic absorption and emission of radiation, which also is a different class of precision experiments. Finally, there are these very long-term theoretical questions, which I guess some of which already came up here earlier today. So first off is the non-abelian structure. So how do you embed CSPs in Yang-Mills or general relativity? And also, what is the Higgs mechanism for CSPs? How do you understand Higgsing a CSP field and getting some massive particles out? That's very important because if you want to think about the photon being a CSP, really what we would like to consider is that actually all the electroweak bosons were CSPs before electroweak symmetry breaking, and then three of them got Higgs and so on. And that is a very pressing question, but something that we don't have the tools to address right now, but that probably can be addressed by considering the CSP field theory more deeply. The second thing is that I alluded to earlier, it appears that these CSP currents do require some degree of non-locality in the sense that they are sourced by inherently extended objects with a size 1/rho. And so we don't really have a microscopic understanding of the origin of where these current couplings come from. So we can write down we kind of have an effective field theory understanding in the sense that we can write down what the currents can be. We can get definite predictions out. We don't really know where the currents come from. And this is, in some sense, it's kind of like the early stages of any physical theory. Like, for example, in the early stages, very early stages of string theory, you had some kind of amplitudes, but not really understanding where those amplitudes came from. So what I'd like to end up saying is there is a vast amount of physics to still consider and discover, many interesting follow-ups. our current focus right now is that we are going to be writing up what we have, what I have presented in this talk, and we're trying to get this paper out as soon as possible in the next couple of weeks. And we're trying to make it self-contained. We understand that a lot of people view the CSB field as a little difficult to get into because there's a vast amount of previous papers with unfamiliar notation and a lot of stuff that is quite technical. So our goal for this paper coming out in the next couple of weeks is that it's going to be short and it will contain everything that anyone needs to answer any of these questions. And it'll also be pedagogical. So hopefully this will be let other people join the field. And the immediate next steps, which we're thinking about right now, of course, are the ones at the top here, which are what are the experimental probes? We have not gone far enough to tell you, like, what is the bound on row? We have some estimates, order of magnitude, but not a concrete number yet. And also these deeper theoretical questions. So I'm quite excited about this because it means that there's a lot of physics to consider and discover. This is kind of an entire arena of precision searches, which is completely motivated by quantum field theory, but which has been completely underexplored in the past 100 years. And so I'm excited to potentially come back in a couple of years and tell you what we found out. Thank you.
So what is the bound on row you guys estimate?
It should be less than nano EV. And that is, we believe the strongest constraint right now is from stellar cooling, but 10 to the minus 9 EV. But that's a very rough estimate, and other things might be much better. We're not sure yet.
Why stellar cooling?
Why what?
Why stellar cooling?
Yeah. The idea being that, well, I don't know. It's just one of those things that comes out. So maybe kind of the analogous thing is that we have not had any bounds from concrete laboratory experiments. So generally, you would expect lab experiments to outperform stellar cooling by a vast amount. But here we just don't really have lab bounds. And so naturally astrophysics ends up being best constraints. There's a second aspect of this, which is that large objects have an advantage. So if you wanted to have a much better laboratory search, you would want to have things as far in the infrared as possible because all these corrections are suppressed by rho times L. And so an example is that you would want to have extremely long antennas. You wouldn't want to have like a small cavity. You want to have like a kilometer long antenna. The kind of stuff that people have used for ultra low frequency radio wave detection, that kind of thing might be competitive, but we have not calculated enough detail to tell you how much better it's going to be.
If you're still assuming that the stronger bound comes from on-shell emission of these guys.
That's correct, though. So that's right. I mean, so the near field, like force law changes, which might come from fifth force surges, those might be much stronger. And we don't really understand that in well enough detail yet to say what those bounds are. Though there is a bit of a caveat, which is that it is true that having like a detecting radiation might be weaker in some cases, but the benefit is that you can scale up your antennas and that will give you a quadratic improvement in the bounds. And so a lot of these fifth force surges are just physically kind of small and you would expect that the corrections be suppressed. But again, this is all like not a definite statement yet.
So how does cavity resonance get affected by this?
Cavity resonance. So if you drive a cavity mode, then the moving electrons in the walls will produce both the ordinary cavity mode inside and also some helicity 0 and 2 radiation. It's kind of like just having a dark photon or something. That extra, the extra degrees of freedom will just propagate out of the cavity. And that radiation will just hit particles in another cavity and then start driving them. And then that can excite a mode in the other cavity. There is a bit of a caveat though, which is that the forces from the CSB radiation are all velocity dependent. And so if you actually had every particle in the other cavity perfectly still, nothing would happen. So that's a little bit confusing, like exactly how do you set up the receiving cavity to actually get something? Like maybe you have to actually excite a different mode so they're actually moving or something like that and do some kind of frequency conversion. I'm not completely sure yet, but we think that a cavity setup should work, but the details are a little bit tricky.
Okay, I have one last question. Like, do you buy, like, does what you are doing violate Bianchi identities?
Bianchi identities?
Yes.
Can you elaborate?
For the photon.
I am not sure. So I think it's kind of just on a different axis than the usual ways we consider modifying electromagnetism. So for example, right, if you take this current and you expand out everything in series, it turns out, first off, the equations of motion for the photon component. So psi has like a mu component inside. Its equation of motion depends on the rank 2 tensor component. And also it's driven by this current J mu, which is not conserved, but the non-conserved, it all works out because there's this mixing. So I'm not really sure, actually. It's like a technical thing. It might, just because a lot of familiar stuff from E&M just won't hold anymore, but I'm really not sure.
So can I ask you something? So the reason why I was asking you about these parastatistics things is that, like, there was this story back in the 50s or 60s that people were trying these different statistics, which is not your case, but it's somehow similar. But what they found in the end, and they were totally happy with it until somebody found that there was an absolutely equivalent description, which was to take the normal fields that we know and love, but extend them with new quantum numbers. So
right.
My question is, how can you be sure that this is just not that you cannot just like consider the normal particles and then just give them additional quantum numbers, maybe some masses or something, and then it's the same?
So there are a few things. So I actually have a couple things to say in response to this. The first thing is, we are sure that there's a physical difference because you have helicity degrees of freedom of arbitrary high helicity. So you can have like helicity 5 radiation, and helicity is a physical observable. So the fact that they have these other helicities when you don't have them for ordinary particles is a very distinctive thing, which is definitely not like an artifact of the description. So
I mean,
for that reason, we're sure it's not just a like a helicity 1 particle with some weird coupling. Now, the other thing is, you could say, what if the description we're using here is not, there's a more familiar description in terms of things we already know about. And so I think I alluded to this earlier, you can always Taylor expand all this stuff out and get rid of the weird eta dependence, and you'll just get a series of scalar, vector, and tensor fields and so on, which are all ordinary scalar, vector, tensor fields with these weird cross couplings. And so in that sense, it is perfectly equivalent to ordinary fields we already know about, but that particular description is just more difficult to use. The third thing is that there's an interesting side story, which is that, so parastatistics turns out to not give you anything new in 3+1 spatial dimensions, but of course in 2+1, you do get something new, which is anions. And the case of CSPs in 2+1 dimensions has actually been considered, and it turns out they are actually kind of anions. So in that sense, it is kind of related to the story.
Okay, great.
Any questions from Zoom? Anyone else?
I have a very stupid question. In the beginning, you mentioned that these could be related to long-standing problems. I'm wondering what you have exactly.
Oh yeah, sure. So this is the part which I actually did not want to put much detail about this in the talk because this is kind of a lot more speculative. Like right now we want to consider if you ask my PhD advisors, they're very excited about the possibility that it solves other things. For example, the long distance, it's a long distance modification of gravity, which appears to be completely well-behaved in the ultraviolet. And so that's something that is quite rare in theories of modified gravity. And one thing this might be able to do is change very, very long range forces. And for example, possibly explain something related to the cosmological constants. There's also an indication that for the, if you have a Yang-Mills CSP, you would automatically forbid theta terms. Like the structure of theta terms would be different. And so this would be an automatic solution of the strong CP problem. Both these things though are extremely speculative. And so I don't wanna lean too heavily on these. Another thing is that the CSP physics can protect the masses of helicity 0 degrees of freedom. And so if you understood something about Higgsing a CSP, maybe that would give you a mechanism to protect the mass of a spin 0 massive particle in a technically natural way, in which case that would have something to do with the hierarchy problem. So there are many, many potential links to exciting other longstanding problems, though every single one of them, of course, does require more theory development than we've done so far. But that's the basic spiel.
Thanks. Another stupid question, maybe I missed. What happens when you go to spin half?
Sure. So there is a fermionic CSP, which has all half integer spins. And so so this thing does not end up being mediating any long range forces because you can't do that with fermions. And it is just an ordinary fermionic field. So you can have a free CSP field theory for fermions. It has an auxiliary variable, which is Grassmann. And a lot of the stuff works out similarly. it just seems to be less relevant to experimental tests. So that's why we didn't think about it in more detail, but it has been worked out. And if you look up fermionic CSPs, I think there are some mathematical physicists that have worked out this in great detail.
Thanks.
There are no other questions. Let's thank the speaker again.